Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Monday, May 13th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writer and box office analyst, Ryan Scott.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
All right, Ryan, I wanted to address our listeners directly here at the top of the show for a second. I know that I typically say this at the end of every episode, but if you can, please rate and review this podcast on whatever platform that you're listening to us on. New reviews legitimately do help put us in front of new listeners, and that helps us to justify continuing to make this show. And I love creating Slash Film Daily, and if you enjoy it too, I would really appreciate you taking just a couple of minutes to help us out on that front. It would really mean a lot to me. So, okay, with that said, on with the show. Ryan, we have to talk about Roger Corman for a minute. The legendary B-movie producer and director died just a couple days ago at age 98. And I mean, to say that Roger Corman was a legendary or a totemic figure in Hollywood almost doesn't do him justice. What are your thoughts on Corman and his legacy?
Look, I'm not going to pretend that I'm a Roger Corman completionist because nobody can be. The man has, if you go to his IMDb, I kid you not, over 900 credits. Look, as a man who grew up watching sci-fi originals, this thing and loves, like, you know, your cheese ball, you know, grindhouse type movie. Like, I just watched Victor Crowley last night, which is like, it's not a Roger Corman movie, but it comes from the house. Like, it comes from the house of Roger Corman. Like, Hollywood history flows through Corman. No question. I just watched over the weekend, because he passed, there was a documentary from 2011 called Corman's World, all about his, you know, legacy, and kind of concludes with him finally getting his honorary Oscar, which I absolutely cried when that happened. And like, you just can't write the story of Hollywood without Roger Corman. And I'm glad that in recent years, it seems like people have finally kind of given him his due. Like, I know he produced a ton of schlock, but like, you know, the guy really gave a lot of people a chance. Like, Ron Howard directed his first movie for Roger Corman. Gaylan Hurd produced her first movie for Roger Corman. Jack Nicholson worked for a decade under Roger Corman before he became a star. Like, you know, but 98 years old, what a life. I mean, if the goalposts are anywhere, you know, like, the guy worked until he died. I mean, it's like him, Stan Lee, Christopher Lee. There's some of these guys that I look at where I'm like, I know death is sad, but my God, if there's a life to celebrate, it's this one.
Yeah, for sure. Well said. I watched that documentary as well. It's funny that you mentioned that, because I think a lot of people were like, if you want sort of a refresher course on, like, you know, what this guy did and sort of an easily digestible, presentation of sort of a little bit of the impact that he had, watch that documentary. It's called Corman's World, and it's a really, really good look. There's a bunch of cool stories in there too. Like, there's this part where he's talking about The Wild Angels, which was like a motorcycle movie that came out before Easy Rider and was the highest grossing indie movie ever made at the time. And Peter Bogdanovich was Roger Corman's assistant on that film, and they didn't have enough extras for a big fight scene, so Roger told Peter Bogdanovich to get in the scene himself, and he was immediately beaten up by real Hell's Angels who were starring in the movie. So, like, there's just all sorts of fun, you know, sort of behind the scenes stuff where, like, Corman's whole thing was squeezing every last opportunity out of a dollar on screen. He would often film scenes in real locations with no permits, no permission. And he was just like a full-on renegade, just like making his own stuff. And like you said, the impact that he had on so many people's careers. I mean, people have published lists of folks who have sort of flowed through the Corman school. And like,
it's insane. It's utterly insane. And also, Jack Nicholson, not a man known for getting overly emotional. Like, there's a moment where he breaks down crying, like getting emotional, thinking about Corman in that documentary. And it's like, it kind of comes out of nowhere. And it's like, it really like hits that the guy... You know, I don't know. I mean, for as much as like Nicholson jokes in that documentary about like Corman not paying him a ton of money, like, he clearly has a lot of reverence for the man.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know. It's just it's one of those things where, sure, you can look at the guy, like, no one's celebrating Dino Croc as a masterpiece of cinema, but like, but, you know, there's even moments of the documentary where you see him, you know, helping in edits and things like that. Like, you can't say the guy didn't care about his work. And, you know, I don't know. I just, I've always had a soft spot for like what Corman stood for. And, so I don't know. It's so sad that he's gone, but at the same time, I mean, if any of us could ever get anywhere near what he accomplished in life and live to 98 and seemingly happy, I mean, geez, you know, that's just great.
I think about the concept of the movie It's a Wonderful Life, where Jimmy Stewart is like suicidal and he wishes that basically like that he wishes to see a world where he was never born, kind of. And Roger Corman might be the single figure in, at least in, let's say, the past 100 years. So maybe not like the person who invented the film camera or whatever, but like, he might be the figure where if you pulled him out of the timeline, the ripple effects might be greater than anyone else, you know, in the past 100 years. It's just wild thinking about that. So rest in peace to Roger Corman, like a true, true legend. All right. So I wanted to mention also this news that came out last week about a new Lord of the Rings movie that is being developed by Warner Brothers Discovery. And if memory serves correct, Ryan, you're not like a huge Lord of the Rings guy. Is that right?
No, I like the Lord of the Rings movies like quite a bit, but I'm not generally a big fantasy guy. So like, I don't obsess over them, but I mean, I think they're masterpieces, you know, I mean, in the sense that like, it's incredible what they accomplished, but I also don't know that it justifies an expansive universe. So I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, much to your chagrin, then, I'm sorry to say, Ryan, Warner Brothers Discovery is moving forward with at least two more Lord of the Rings movies. I think the first of which, it's unclear to me, Ryan, I don't know if you got a better sense of this. In this announcement that came out last week, they're basically saying a new movie is in the works. It's called Lord of the Rings, The Hunt for Gollum. I don't know if they're already planning on it being a two-part thing or if that's just the name of the first movie and then another movie is coming on.
Well, they have the animated War of the Rohirrim. That's supposed to be
War of
out.
The Rohirrim. Yeah, yeah. That's
But so I think that might be what they're talking. Like, so that's already, because they talked a bit about that at CinemaCon. So that's on the schedule for December. Whether or not that stays, I'm not sure. But
okay, I wasn't sure if that counted as one of the two that they were talking about.
So. I think that's what they're talking about. I certainly hope that we're not getting into a cart before horse situation where they're like, yeah, they have that plus these two more. I'm not sure, but my sense is that they might have been talking about that anime.
I wouldn't be surprised because cart before the horse with IP seems like sort of the standard operating procedure in Hollywood these days.
It really does. In my Tales from the Box Office column, like I have a little lessons thing at the end that I always do. And there's times where I'm like, I can't possibly say the cart before the horse thing again, can I? But like, that's often been a thing where it's like, well, it happens a lot and I wish people would learn, but yeah.
So Andy Serkis, who played Gollum in that original trilogy, he also reprised that role in the Hobbit films. Let's just pretend those don't exist for the purposes of this conversation. He's coming back to star as Gollum in this new film. He's also going to be directing the movie, which I find really interesting. Peter Jackson, who obviously directed all of the previous Lord of the Rings films, that starting with the one in the Fellowship in 2001, he and Philippa Boyens and Fran Walsh are coming back to be involved in this new movie in some capacity. I think Jackson is producing and Boyens and Walsh are also producing, but they're going to be co-writing the script too. So yeah, just interesting stuff. I'm actually happy personally that Peter Jackson is not directing this new movie again. Like I feel like maybe we'll be in for a little bit of a different vibe or something without him necessarily in that full position of power behind the camera there. And I love the original trilogy, but like the Hobbit movies just made me sad. So I just don't want to see Peter Jackson sort of fall back into that world and get sucked into doing something that he's not like super, super passionate about. And Andy Serkis is obviously incredibly passionate about Gollum. Like that is a character that completely altered the course of his entire career. And he, it seems to me from all of the quotes and stuff that came out around this announcement that he like has passion for the story and wants to sort of do this character right. So,
It definitely like, and Andy Serkis fascinates me as a director. Like it seems unfortunate that like he had that Mowgli Legend of the Jungle movie that came out like around the same time of Disney's Jungle Book and got buried. Like that wasn't really his fault. For whatever it's worth, I think like Venom Let There Be Carnage was better than the first Venom. He did the job he was asked to do. Like, I don't know that he's even gotten like a fully fair shake as a director yet. Mm-hmm. So like, I think it's cool that he's the one doing it. like, I'm not inspired by that title at all. Like, I think they might need to come up with a better title, but like, but you know, we'll see. Like, I mean, but like, to your point about not ignoring the Hobbit movies, like, for Warner Brothers, they can't be ignored. Like, The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, one of the most boring first hours of a blockbuster I've ever seen in my life, made over $1 billion. That trilogy made almost $3 billion. So, like, that's why we're getting these. Like, for anyone that ever complains about these things, vote with your dollars, people. You know, like, that's the thing I always say. So that's why this is happening.
Yeah. And if you want to know more about, like, what this might actually be about, because, you know, if you're listening to this and you're pretty familiar with the Lord of the Rings trilogy, you're like, wait a second, Gollum dies at the very end of this. And we also saw flashbacks showing how he became Gollum. So, like, what could this possibly be about? Jeremy Mathai at Slash Film wrote a whole article called The Hunt for Gollum Question You Probably Have Answered by a Lord of the Rings Expert. And he gets into some plot stuff there that seems pretty likely in terms of where this is going to go. And then also, like, the surprising characters that are going to come back for the story that they will presumably have to recast. So that should be a really interesting conversation to be having in the months ahead. So we will probably have that conversation as soon as that information comes out. So okay, before we take a break, Ryan, I wanted to mention one more news story here, which is that a Matchbox movie is in the works from director Sam Hargrave, who is the stunt coordinator, second unit director, action guy extraordinaire, who transitioned to becoming a feature filmmaker with the Extraction films for Netflix and starring Chris Hemsworth. So Sam Hargrave is now making a Matchbox movie, yes, based on the Matchbox cars. This is Mattel's latest film, or sort of the, you know, our headline for this says Matchbox movie gets seasoned action director as we see what Barbie's success has wrought. So that's basically what's happening now. I think a lot of people are sort of bummed that, like, oh, this is the lesson that that Hollywood is taking from Barbie's success, is just make more toy movies. I think we knew this was going to happen.
Yes. I hesitate to get so down on it so quickly. Where it's like, okay, yes, it's like, obviously we've needed a franchise hook in things for a long time. And I think, like, okay, yeah, maybe on the surface, it seems like that's the lesson, but maybe, just maybe, and I'm not saying for sure, but I'm saying, like, maybe this guy has a way to make this interesting for action and have something to say. Like, Barbie is just a doll in some ways. And, like, what Greta Gerwig did with that movie is incredible. Maybe, just maybe, there's a way to do that with Matchbox. I don't want to get down on this too early. Like, I don't like to, but I agree. But I do agree that Hollywood is definitely like, what toys can we make now? Like, we'll see.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah. And I think it's notable that, like, the Extraction movies don't really have a ton of car chase stuff in there, but he's clearly a guy who knows his way around an action scene. And Matchbox is just, it's Matchbox cars. There's no story to it. So, like, if you can come up with a story that is great and has, like, compelling characters, there is an opportunity here for a fun movie. So I'm kind of right there with you. I'm not necessarily looking down my nose at this quite yet, other than just
what,
like,
a comp for me would be like Rampage, the Dwayne Johnson movie. And I'm not saying you have to love that movie. Like, I really like that movie a lot. But what that movie did was, like, okay, Rampage is a ridiculously simple game where you just control a monster that destroys a city. And so what they did is they looked at that as, like, okay, this title was popular enough. The Rock is a big enough star. We can just kind of make a monster movie here. And, like, that's our IP hook. And they might be able to do something similar here. So that's, like, one of the things I look at where I'm like, maybe let's give this a, let's see what happens. Like, I'm not saying, look, it might suck and we might just come back to this conversation and look silly, but at the same time, like, I like to give stuff the benefit of the doubt. I always think back to the Lego movie and I'm like, how dumb did that sound until it came out? You know, like, so, you know, we'll see.
And another piece of information that kind of has me, like, has my eyebrows raised a little bit is the writers on this. I don't know if you saw this part, but David Kogeshall, I think is how you pronounce his name, who wrote Orphan First Kill and Prey, and Jonathan Tropper, who created Warrior, the martial arts series that was on Max for a while. I think might still be airing, actually. These are the two guys who are writing the script. So, like, I've not seen Warrior yet. I've had it recommended to me by so many people, but Prey ruled. And
yeah,
Jonathan Tropper seems like a, you know, Warrior, from everything I've heard, sounds like a pretty kick-ass series.
My mom won't shut up about that show. Like, she begs me because I don't watch a ton of TV, she's like, she begs me to watch that show. Like, so yeah, like I had the same thought you did where I'm like, okay, like, cause that was one of the things that like if you had had the guys that wrote Morbius doing this, you know, like right. those guys who keep getting, and again, I'm sympathetic to like those guys write a script and what happens happens. But like, if you had like those guys doing this, I'd be like, oh no. But like, yeah, you have a couple of guys whose recent output is incredibly impressive. So, you know, like, and I'm not saying you have to like those Extraction movies a lot, but like, you can't deny that the action on this, like Sam Hargrave knows what he's doing with the camera, yeah. you know? So like, so, you know, there's potential here for sure.
Yeah. I actually like the Extraction movies. I know that's not necessarily like a hugely popular opinion among film critics and stuff like that.
But, you and I have talked about this. I genuinely love the first Extraction. The second one left me feeling less thrilled, but like, there's a couple of impressive things in it. Like that prison fight is awesome in the second.
Oh yeah. Film, unreal. So. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's take a break and then we'll come back and we have some more news to talk about.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
All right. So typically we talk about box office stuff in the first half of this, these Monday episodes, Ryan. We had some Corman stuff to talk about that sort of took over that part of the conversation, but let's get into that now. So tell me about the box office performance of the biggest movies at the theaters last week.
Yeah. So as you all know, if you've listened to this podcast for any amount of time, I was deliriously excited about the release of Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. And to my delight, it did well for itself. Now, this is one of those like unsexy results. It fell right in line with expectations. It made $56.5 million domestically, which was just a hair more than War for the Planet of the Apes. And what I've said from the beginning, what a lot of box office analysts said, if this can like kind of match War for the Planet of the Apes, we're probably in good shape. That movie made $490 million worldwide. A lot of that came from China. So, you know, as we've talked about, China's not as big with American movies in the pandemic era. So that's going to be complicated. But this movie has a $160 million budget, which is pretty reasonable for a movie like this. So if it can get to $400 million worldwide, it's in good shape. You take China out of the equation, if it can match War, it should get to 400. And you know, we're off to a decent start internationally. It made 72.5 million from I think 52 markets, which was a little under expectations, but still good. So it's up to $129 million global start. You know, the reviews have been good. A lot of people made a lot of bones about the B cinema score, and that surprised me at first as well. But the Hollywood Reporter had some context there, which is that most people gave it like an A minus or a B. But then there was like a small number of people that graded it very low. So it still seems like the majority of like reactions leaving the theater were good. It's just that the people that it rubbed really wrong. Mm. So like that wasn't. But anyway, point being, it's off to a good start. It's not like it didn't fall well below. So there's not a lot to talk. It didn't like blow the doors off it. So there's not, you know. But the one thing I will say is that next weekend we have John Krasinski's If coming out, or I should say this weekend, I'm sorry, John Krasinski's If coming out, which is very much a family-friendly movie. And then you have The Strangers Chapter 1, which is more of like a hard R horror movie. Mm-hmm. So I think neither of those is going to take a lot away from Kingdom. And then I would argue that what we're going to look at when we talk next Monday is probably the healthiest top five that we've had in ages. So, you know, because you're going to have all those movies, I think will do relatively well. So yeah, look, it's a good start for Kingdom. It's more of a proper start to summer. It's encouraging. And as someone who left Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, like deliriously excited for what's going to come next, I'm really hopeful this movie continues to do well. So Ben, did you see Kingdom yet?
I did. I really, really enjoyed it. I think it left me maybe not quite as like emotionally stirred as some of the previous movies have. But man, like, yeah, just really solid, high quality blockbuster entertainment. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah. What I thought about is like this sort of seemed like So of the previous trilogy, Rise was definitely my least favorite, but it's such a good start to what ended up happening. And I think that Kingdom is probably taking a similar path where it put a lot on the table, and that like by the end of the movie, I'm not spoiling anything, but I think obviously they were always going to set up a sequel, and what they set up is very thrilling to me. And mm-hmm. so I hope we get to a place where we at least get to see what that next movie is. So I think that this sets Disney up in a position where this movie does well. If they can not take 4 years to get a sequel out, they can probably capitalize, much like Dawn of the Planet of the Apes did, you know, where you get like a bit of a breakout sequel. So encouraging stuff.
So what about The Fall Guy? I'm so curious about how this movie might last or not last over the course of the summer. So how did that movie perform? What was its percentage drop? That kind of thing you seem to pay
It's kind of fascinating because, like, you know, if you're on film Twitter, which is a bubble, like there were a lot of people that were like, The Fall Guy held great. And then other people sort of sending the doom bell. And I'm kind of in the middle. It dropped basically 50% from its opening weekend, which is fine. Someone had asked me like what it would take for, you know, to be considered hopeful, like in a second weekend. And my feeling was if it dropped like 40%, we could be hopeful. So 50% is okay. Like, I think we just got so used to like blockbusters dropping like nearly 60% in a second weekend that like anything less than that feels really good. Mm-hmm. And not to say that a 50% hold is terrible. It's just that it's not going to be enough it's not enough to save a movie that underperformed. So I think what I keep coming back to at this point, well, let's talk. So I guess let's look at the overall picture. The Fall Guy now is at basically 104 million worldwide after two weekends. So, you know, for a movie with $130 million budget, it's really still got a long way to go. What I keep coming back to is that this probably shouldn't have been a $130 million movie. I know I harp on the budget stuff a lot, but, you know, if this had been like The Lost City, you know, with like a $70, $80 million budget, we'd be talking about it a lot differently. And I just think that that's what it probably needed to be. So I don't know if that means you got to pay people less. I don't know what that means, but I think that this movie is probably going to finish with around Bullet Train numbers, so around 200 worldwide, give or take, and that's just not going to be enough. So, you know, I don't know. I can't guarantee at this point, but after that second weekend, you see the hold. It's probably going to hold well enough, but it might save Universal from like really losing their ass on this movie, but it's not going to become like a sleeper success or anything, I don't think.
So you're talking about theatrically, obviously, but I do wonder if this might be the type of movie that has enough interest for audiences that they want to see it, but they don't want to leave their homes for it. And so once it becomes available on the paid VOD window, I wonder if this could be like a smash hit for Universal that way. Because I feel like a lot of their movies play in theaters for a little while, and they've been sort of at the forefront, especially with like literally at the forefront with Trolls World Tour right in the start of the pandemic, smashing the window there
and basically
just putting stuff on digital. And I think a lot of Universal stuff has been really, really successful on VOD. So I wonder if this movie might have sort of a longer tail, like after the conversation effectively ends for it theatrically.
Yeah, Universal has vocally been the best at capitalizing on the VOD windows. And they are also the ones that opened Pandora's box with Trolls World Tour. And I'll never forgive them for that. But, well, there's a book to be written about that, and I don't have the time to write it. But anyway, so I don't disagree. And that's what I mean by, like, Universal might not lose their ass on this movie. Like, over a long enough timeline, they might, you know, but you talk about, okay, $130 million budget, and they, the marketing campaign, they went all in. So probably $100 million marketing campaign. Mm-hmm. So you're in $230 million, and that's after tax rebates and everything else. So, you know, you have to make $230 million. Let's say it finishes with 200 worldwide. You still have $130 million to make up. You know, so like, I'm not saying it can't over time make money, but I'm saying that like, you don't spend that kind of money on a movie like this, hoping to break even down the line. That's more the issue, I think. So I don't disagree with you. And I think that like, once people catch up with it, they're going to be like, oh wow, that was nice. But, although I will say this though, as a guy who champions the theatrical experience a lot, I go to the Alamo Draft House a lot, and I go to some of these places, even Cinemark, but I went to a Regal last week for the first time in a long time. And that was a bit of a reality check for me, where like, I really didn't enjoy the experience very much at all. And I, realized that's what a lot of people are working with. And I kind of was like, okay, I can see where if all you have around you is like your average dying Regal cinema, that this does not feel like, ooh, some big cherished experience. So yeah. I think one of the things I'm coming back to now is like some of these theaters really need to like step their game up, but that's another conversation entirely.
Yeah. Okay. What other box office stuff did you want to touch on here?
I think those are the big ones. The only thing we'll talk about this next week, but Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire is very close now. I think a little less than $10 million from passing Kong Skull Island to become the highest grossing movie in the MonsterVerse. And as of Friday, they have announced that another entry is officially in development with Dave Callahan, who wrote Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings and had a story credit, interestingly enough, on the 2014 Godzilla. He is going to write the next one. So
okay.
So we have, you know, so that franchise is off and running. Last thing, real quick, not we don't need to talk about this a ton, but Civil War has hung on, and it is now only the second A24 movie ever to cross $100 million worldwide. So,
hey, that's that. Cool.
Hey, that's not bad. It's still got a little bit of ways to go to make money, but it's on its way.
Okay. All right. So I think I'm trying to remember exactly what day this was announced. I think it was Thursday or Friday of last week. Basically, Disney Plus, Hulu, and Max are going to be offered as a bundle subscription starting this summer. We don't really have any pricing information yet about, you know, how much it's going to cost for the ad tier or the non-ad tier. The news was this bundle, which David Zaslav, the CEO of Warner Brothers Discovery, has been sort of teasing and like openly hoping for in the press. This is actually happening now. So I think both of us have the gut reaction here, Ryan, which is just like, well, we're back to cable, essentially. I mean, this is something that we've been talking about on the podcast for a long time. A lot of industry analysts have made this observation as well. Pretty soon, you know, these bundles are just going to start to resemble the old cable bill, which used to be an astronomical price point for a lot of people. But now it's just replacing that with a bunch of streaming services. So do we have anything to say really beyond that? I mean, maybe we'll probably update the story a little bit, you know, talk about it in a future episode when that actual pricing information comes out, just to sort of put it on people's radar. Because I know a lot of people don't want to be subscribed to a ton of different things, and actually taking a discount for a bundle makes a lot of sense in some ways. So I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on this?
I don't know how heavy the discount's going to be. I don't know what the split's going to be. But yeah, I mean, this was always the inevitability here, for better or worse. I would argue worse, but that's another conversation entirely. Yeah, I don't know. I'm starting to feel a little despondent over all this streaming stuff, honestly. I don't know that this is a better experience for consumers. Like, I'm even at the point now where they integrated Hulu into Disney Plus. And now it just seems so messy. Like, it doesn't make any sense, really. Like, it's all just like, why? I don't know. I think one of the things I sort of liked about Disney Plus is that it made sense as Disney Plus. And now with everything, with other stuff integrated into it, it sort of feels like, you know, if you were flipping around cable and then, like, you know, Disney XD shows were showing up on FX or something, like, it doesn't really make sense. So yeah, this is just going to make it messier. And it was sort of the similar thing when Discovery took over HBO Max, and then that became Max, and now you just have a bunch of reality TV stuff in with Criterion stuff, or you know, Turner Classic Movies or whatever. And it's like, it just it's too homogenous. Like, it's too, I think, like, you know, for it to be cable again, you have to have more distinction between like channels made sense. And streaming has got to find a way to sort of, like, it doesn't necessarily have to be live with commercials all the time, but you've got to find a way to sort of, like, break everything up for people again.
Well, I think the good news is that they're not planning on incorporating Max content into a single user interface type of thing. Like, they're not going to incorporate the Max stuff in with Disney Plus and make that, you know, that show right next to a Hulu show or whatever. It's just going to be, in terms of pricing and payments and stuff for people, this bundle. So yeah, you'll still have to go to the Max app to watch things there. The Disney Plus and Hulu thing, that consolidation has already happened. So, like, we're stuck with that messiness. You know,
for
there's
now,
nothing you can do really about that, except for, I guess, if you want to, which is what I do personally, just go to the Hulu app and just watch Hulu stuff there. And I just kind of, like, ignore all the Hulu stuff on Disney Plus whenever I'm over there. So,
yeah. I guess what I'm getting at, though, is that, like, more integration feels inevitable. Like, it definitely feels like, in some way, shape, or form, this stuff will become more integrated some way.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Like, I'm just at a point where the streaming business is starting to get to a point where we're at an inflection point where things are going to start happening. And it's at a point where I don't really know what's going to happen. And I don't know if it's going to be for better or worse. And I don't know who's going to be there at the end of the day. And I'm just now just sort of left to, like, I'm an onlooker and I don't know. I'm just as curious as anyone else is. So we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we all have time for a couple more stories that I wanted to touch on real quick. The Office spinoff is officially in the works. It's officially been announced. Peacock is going to be the home of this thing. So I guess depending on, they're probably almost certainly going to make it part of the paid tier of Peacock. So that kind of sucks for me because I don't subscribe to Peacock. I mean, speaking of dealing with, you know, all these bundles and subscriptions and stuff like that, Peacock is one of the few streamers that I do not subscribe to, but I might have to because this Office spinoff seems like it could be kind of a big deal. I guess it could completely crash and burn, but Donald Gleason, who stars in the new Star Wars trilogy, and he was in About Time. He's Brendan Gleeson's son, is a great actor on his own accord. He's great. He's going to be starring in this alongside Sabrina Impacciatore, who was in The White Lotus season 2, and they're going to be leading a new ensemble cast. And the story for this, the synopsis for this new spinoff show, reads as follows. The documentary crew that immortalized Dunder Mifflin's Scranton branch is in search of a new subject when they discover a dying historic Midwestern newspaper and the publisher trying to revive it with volunteer reporters. So I don't know, this one kind of hits a little close to home for us, Ryan, you know, being in this industry.
Sure does. Yeah.
But, you know, you got Greg Daniels, who's the creator of the American version of The Office, coming back. And so that gives me some hope that, like, maybe this isn't just going to be like a pure cash grab. Obviously, NBC Universal and Peacock have been wanting to do something like this for a long time because The Office has been such a gargantuan success for them in terms of, like, one of the, you know, it's been like one of the shows that, you know, it costs like hundreds of millions of dollars to get the rights for streaming The Office because it's a show that just everybody constantly has on. So returning to this universe, but without necessarily relying on having to pay, you know, Steve Carell to come back or whatever to show up, like maybe there will be cameos or something like that, but setting it in a completely different sort of industry makes a lot of sense and seems like it could be a good approach here. So I'm curious about this. What do you think about it?
I mean, The Office is, I'm not a big TV guy, but it's one of the few shows that I, you know, like went, you know, front to back with, and I've rewatched a bunch, and I was super skeptical about this, like some sort of rival, but I like the idea of just saying, like, we're taking a similar concept and applying it to a completely different industry. Like Parks and Recreation in some way took that Office style of show filmmaking and just applied it to like a parks department. Mm-hmm. So like, and Parks and Recreation is a phenomenal show. So you could theoretically do the same thing here. You know,
yeah, and even like Brooklyn Nine-Nine basically did the same thing too. So yeah.
Yeah. So I'm into this. And I also think that like The Office has been one of the only things that has helped prop up Peacock. So like, obviously this was always going to happen, but I'm also, a lot can happen in the time that the show is like filmed and developed from the time it would be released like a year from now. And I'm, it seems like NBC is pretty stubbornly sticking with Peacock, but it's the streaming service I'm most skeptical about in the long run. So we'll see.
Okay. All right. Last story real quick. Friday the 13th TV show has lost its showrunner, Brian Fuller, who's become a showrunner who is basically known at this point as much for developing and leaving shows as he has, you know, as he is for actually creating shows. What do you think about this, Brian? I know you're a big horror guy.
Yeah. So let's quickly go over what happened. So Brian Fuller, for those who may not remember, I believe it was early last year, so this has already been over a year, Brian Fuller of Hannibal fame was reported to be developing a Friday the 13th TV series called Crystal Lake with A24, which was what was fascinating to people. And Fuller, from the beginning, it was going to focus a lot more on Pamela Voorhees, Jason's mother. Yeah, like that's what we knew. And then like things had been really quiet, and now Fuller has left. There was a lot of scuttlebutt about this last week because there were reports that like A24 was retooling the show. Nobody knew what that meant. And then, yeah, Fuller just came out and confirmed they're moving in a different direction. Some stuff has since come out, like Kevin Williamson, who wrote the Scream movies, was apparently going to write an episode, and it was going to be an hour long chase episode. And so, like, people are like mourning already what could have been. I was always like a little like, I want a new Friday the 13th movie more than I want most other things. So I was really excited about the prospect of this show only because it demonstrated that, like, maybe we can finally get a Friday the 13th thing. Mm-hmm. I wasn't super thrilled about a Pamela Voorhees thing. But I guess TV was the loophole, as is my understanding. So, like, who knows? Maybe A24 is just going, maybe we just need to go focus on Jason more. I don't know. But yeah, it is odd. I and again, this was supposed to be for Peacock, by the way. So this was another thing that, like, Peacock was investing in to hopefully prop up the service. Who knows what happens from now, but it just does feel like, yeah, it's been 15 years since a Friday the 13th movie happened. This show, it's probably going to be closer to 20 years by the time this show actually ends up, you know, hitting the airwaves. So there's no knowing who's going to take over at this point. No knowing if it's actually going to move forward. Like, if maybe they just scrap it, I don't know. It just feels like, man, it's crazy to me that it is this hard to just get Jason in a hockey mask with a machete killing people by a lake. It is crazy. But yeah.
Yeah. There's all sorts of, like, super complicated legal issues and stuff, which is part of the
reason
why it's taken that long. Yeah.
For people that don't know, I will go over this as quickly as humanly possible. What happened some years ago is Victor Miller, the screenwriter of the original Friday the 13th, wound up in a lawsuit with Sean Cunningham, who directed the original Friday the 13th. And basically, there was a rights dispute, and Victor Miller has been ruled in favor of in a couple of court rulings. But the problem is, he got the rights to that original Friday the 13th script, and that was only in, like, North America, because copyright law doesn't apply worldwide. Now, as you recall, the original Friday the 13th, Jason was hardly in it. Pamela Voorhees was the killer. There's no hockey mask. There's no none of that stuff. So, yeah, maybe Victor Miller gets the name and those elements, but it doesn't mean he can use Jason. So the rights kind of ended up split up, which is odd. That's why it's been hard.
It's really tough to make a movie when you effectively have, like, one hand tied behind your back, you know, in terms of story and stuff and what you can and can't say and can and can't use with, like, all of the iconography and stuff like that people expect from a project like this.
So, yes. And so the idea is somehow Fuller and everyone there managed to get the rights wrangled together for TV, you know, not for a movie, but they for TV managed to put together all of the rights. So they were going to be able to use everything. Like, nothing was off the table. And so, you know, again, this doesn't mean a movie's coming, because, again, like, Victor Miller and Cunningham would have to come together and make an agreement. I'm wondering now, with this falling apart, maybe we're closer to that. Like, if this really does just fall apart, maybe Miller and Cunningham finally go, okay, let's just figure this out. But yeah, so I don't know. That's where we're at.
Okay, fingers crossed. We'll see what happens. We'll see if we ever see another Friday the 13th project again. But good luck to this show and whoever picks up the gauntlet or whatever as the next showrunner here. And good luck to Brian Fuller hopefully one day he'll be able to actually produce another show all the way through, from, you know, develop it from the beginning to the end and have it not be, like, canceled mid-run or whatever. I would love to see, like, a fully realized Brian Fuller project one of these days. So okay, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find much more about all the stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com. I will link to a bunch of them in the show notes. Also, Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.